The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
And we go again. It's 5 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 6th of December, 2023. You're very welcome along to the middle show of the week of the 9 till noon show. How are you all keeping it there? Hope you're very well. Indeed, as Lee was saying there just before the news, a bit of a change to the weather. I might not have thawed everywhere yet, but certainly we're not seeing that cold weather we've had for the last wee while. But anyway, we'll crack on regardless of the weather. The lines are open for you right now to get involved in the conversation, to trigger your own. If there's something that you want to talk about, a piece of information you want to pass on, an issue you think we should be talking about, or something positive as well that you think needs to be platformed, please get in touch with us. You can call us on 074-91-25000. We've got Caroline, as always, taking your calls, and Shannon assisting Caroline as well and looking after the social media. If you want to WhatsApp or text or send a WhatsApp voice message, please use this number, 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. And of course, we want to listen to you, hear from you wherever you're listening, outside the Republic. We still have those crazy international dial tones in 2023 with AI about to overtake the world. But anyway, 00353 86 60 25000. That's the WhatsApp or text number. I'll remind you how you can watch the show as well already. Nice to see so many of you on board. Annie and Dolores amongst those watching the programme already. Okay, the Finn Valley Voice this morning. The family of Ronan O'Ruddy, the 44-year-old Stranraer man who died in January, have been told that an independent investigation into the treatment from Letterkenny University Hospital is nearing completion. The father of a Donegal man with Down syndrome who died in January has spoken of the family's horrendous experience in Letterkenny University Hospital. On Thursday night, his father, Phil, addressed a public meeting at the Mount Airgal Hotel, which was organised by the Letterkenny Hospital Campaign Group, where he outlined the difficulties they encountered. And that's featured across the front of that paper and inside it this morning. The Inish Times this morning: local Garda bosses hope to have a new superintendent allocated to the Buncrana district shortly. Chief Superintendent Aidan Glacken has confirmed that a request has been made to have a recent vacancy filled. Superintendent Barry Doyle transferred to Sligo in early October. In January, he succeeded Greta Sheridan as superintendent in the Buncrana district. There are now three superintendents in the Donegal Garda division: Karen Doyle in Ballyshannon, Greta Sheridan in Letterkenny, and David Kelly in Milford. Chief Superintendent Glacken has asked Garda Commissioner Drew Harris that the void in Buncrana be addressed at a meeting of the Donegal Joint Policing Committee on Friday. Chief Superintendent Glacken was asked about the makeup of the Donegal division. There are currently three superintendents, but none in Buncrana, he said, in response to a query from Donegal JPC Chair Councillor Jerry McMonagall. On to the Donegal Post this morning. A cold, crispy Bundoran on Monday afternoon was the order of the day when a sod-turning ceremony of sorts, or an unplanned solo mission by councillors from the Donegal Municipal District, took place at the site of a new multi-million social housing unit development in the east end of the resort. Preliminary groundwork has already commenced on the new 12.5 million 42 housing unit development at Drumacrin in Bundoran over the past week, which will be the first major social housing investment in Bundoran in 20 years. Moving on to the Nationals now, and we are rich again as a country, apparently. Corporation tax receipts have defied predictions of a slump, with record returns last month pointing to another strong year for the public finances. Alarm bells had been ringing in the Department of Finance after receipts from the business tax fell for three consecutive months between August and October, posing a risk to the government's budgetary arithmetic. But I would imagine you would feel they should have a good, reliable hold on this. But they got a big surprise, because the latest Exchequer returns show the government collected a record €6.3 billion in corporation tax receipts in November alone. That's €1.3 billion, or 27% higher than the amount collected in the same month last year. It brought corporate tax receipts for the year to date to €22 billion, 4.2% up on last year, and on course to exceed the government's $23.5 billion forecast, which had begun to look shaky in recent months. November is the biggest month of the year for corporate tax, as most companies with a December financial year end make a preliminary payment. But the finances are incredibly strong. And I think it puts to bed really that argument of why you're spending money here when you should be spending money there. You know, people pitching one group against another, when the reality is there's a massive excess in billions that if they wanted to, could be spent on a lot of these stuff. Although that being said, I did hear the finance minister saying that they are using the money on housing, health, the Gardaí, etc. But it's what people feel on the ground, isn't it? On to the Irish Independent now. And Meath residents face Ireland's longest average commute to get to work, according to a Central Statistics Office study published yesterday. They spent an average of 35 minutes getting to their place of work. Wow, that would be dreamy. This compares with a 23-minute journey for the average employer in Galway City, who enjoys the shortage average commute. While Meath's average journey time is the highest, it's closely followed by the average 34-minute travel of workers from Kildare, Wicklow and Fingal. Meath also has the highest proportion of workers who endure commutes of over an hour. More than one in four of all commuters from Laytown, Bettystown, Morningtown and Donnacarney in Meath, and it goes to townlands around Meath, take over an hour or more to travel to work. I think a lot of people in Donegal do too, but anyway, it's not reflected in these figures. What is the employment rate? The employment rate was 8% in April last year across the country. That's down from 13% in the 2016 census and from 19% in the 2011 census. The counties, though, with the highest unemployment rates were Louth, Longford and Donegal at 11%. So we have an unemployment rate at 3% above the national average here in Donegal. The Irish Daily Mail this morning: Sinn Féin's attempt to remove the Justice Minister spectacularly backfired last night, with the main opposition party being hit by a series of scathing political attacks. After winning the confidence motion by 20 votes, a defiant Helen McEntee told the Dáil that Sinn Féin wanted instability and not solution, saying their mantra is to sack, sue and bully. She added, "It may surprise Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald to know this is not an episode of The Apprentice. You cannot fire your way out of the situation." In a blistering debate, let's go inside here. Where is it? Page six. In a blistering debate, Sinn Féin leader was compared to former US President Donald Trump when she was accused of seeking to exploit the crisis following riots in Dublin after three children and a childcare worker were stabbed outside of a school. So do you believe Sinn Féin were right to move that motion of no confidence? I have sort of indicated I couldn't understand the logic to it, to be honest with you, at this time. It seems to have backfired, or at least that's what the papers are saying. Or do you think it was the right thing to do? What do you think? 086 60 25,000, were Sinn Féin right? There were names being bandied around the place as well. Someone had a go at Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty as well. I don't want to misquote it, but anyway, I'm not sure of the motivation of it, if it was just a statement on that debate or if it was a dig about people's past or history. I'm not really quite sure, but anyway, it got quite feisty in the Dáil last night. In the Irish Daily Star this morning, former Northern Ireland and Celtic footballer Paddy McCourt has successfully appealed against a conviction for a sexual assault. The 40-year-old of Wheatfield Court in Muff, Donegal, was found guilty after a trial in May of sexually touching a woman in a bar in Derry in January 2022. At Derry Magistrates Court in July, District Judge Ted McGill handed down a three-month sentence, which was suspended for 2 years. Mr. McCourt always denied the allegations, and he successfully appealed against the conviction yesterday after Northern Ireland's Public Prosecution Service offered no evidence. During a brief hearing at the County Court in Derry, Rosemary Walsh appeared for the PPS, said they had issues around witnesses who previously identified Mr. McCourt. This was a matter concerning an allegation of sexual assault against Mr. McCourt, and there hadn't been a dispute as part of the lower court proceedings that the victim was the subject of a sexual assault by one of two individuals who were at a bar and situated just behind her at the material time, she said. But that he successfully appealed that conviction there. On to the Sun this morning, and maybe you did hear Richard Boyd Barrett's speech on Israel. He didn't hold back. He's been questioned about it and is not backing down. A TD has refused to apologise after branding Israel a filthy, apartheid, racist regime and a psychopathic state, which is quite the statement, really, because it really paints absolutely everybody with the one brush. And I believe there are people within Israel with different political views, but he said the entire state is a psychopath. People Before Profits' Richard Boyd Barrett made the statement on a pro-Palestine march in Dublin on Saturday. It had called for the Israeli ambassador to be expelled from Ireland. Mr. Boyd Barrett told the rally, "This should be a moment of truth for people who have lied to us or are lying to themselves that a state that is capable of doing this is a psychopath." Boyd Barrett added that the filthy, apartheid, racist, colonial settler regime that is Israel needs to be dismantled. Incredibly strong words, which I wouldn't be surprised would be borderline facing the wrath of any new hate speech laws, you would imagine. And finally, stranger things have happened than Conor McGregor seeking the presidency. He is flirting with the idea. I think he's playing it down today with a bit of a joke. But anyway, Elon Musk, who's an incredibly influential person, whether you like him or not, he has backed Conor McGregor to run for the president of Ireland after he claimed to be considering the career change. The UFC star tweets are being investigated by Gardaí for allegedly inciting hate, but that has not stopped him voicing his views on X. After the Dubliner dismissed his likely rivals Gerry Adams and Kenny and Bertie Ahern on age grounds, ex-owner Musk tweeted, "I think you could take them all single-handed. Not even fair." McGregor, whose fiancée Dee Devlin gave birth to their fourth child last week, responded with a lengthy post which said, "I'd fancy my chances, Elon, 100%. And in some of his comments, he seems to misunderstand Conor McGregor, the sort of role of president and the impact a president might have and what they have a say on and so on and so forth. But anyway, that is where we're at with the papers today. A high-tech skin cancer service which could provide rapid treatment for patients has still not been fully taken up by more than two-thirds of the 13 national dermatology departments, despite its uptake in Dublin hospitals, amongst them Letterkenny University Hospital. Owen O'Reilly is CEO of Allview Healthcare, and he joins us on the programme now. Thank you for your time this morning, Owen.
Greg, thank you very much. Thanks for talking to me.
Right, before we talk about the uptake, talk to me a little bit about how this, as it's described, groundbreaking service works and what element of it is groundbreaking.
Okay, so Allview Healthcare, we are a national provider to both public and private for dermatology, ophthalmology, plastic surgery, vascular, some other services. But in dermatology in particular, we'd be the largest dermatology provider in the state. And how we do that is through teledermatology as a tool within our service. So a patient would come into a nurse-led clinic within a clinic, and we have a local clinic in Letterkenny, Sligo, Galway, we have them all around the country. So you come into a nurse-led clinic, and that nurse uses basically specialist medical equipment, which takes microscopic photographs of the skin, of the lesions, they can see the blood cells. So enabling that, all those images, so a patient could have about 50 images taken in a case, that is up into the cloud where consultants around the country are able to diagnose that. And the specialist part about this is the best consultant for that case sees your case. So the technology, if you have a lesion, so dermatologists have subspecialties, acnes, lesions, psoriasis, you know, pediatrics, and our system will allow your set of images, the patient's set of images, and all their medical history and their GP notes all be put in front of the right consultant. So that means you're getting the right care at the right time. Now that allows the consultant to give a diagnosis and a treatment plan. About half those patients don't need to see the consultant face-to-face. So our GPs, we have a half dozen GPs work for us as well in our service. They will actually contact the patient, discuss the consultant notes, issue the prescriptions to them. However, about 35% of them will need surgery, and about 15-20% will end up seeing the consultant face-to-face for full skin exams and onward management of psoriasis and different conditions.
So just in terms of how it works in the hospitals where this is employed, how would someone end up in front of one of your nurses? Are they referred? Can people pay to access it? Or how does all that work?
Both. So they can pay themselves just to come and use their service. If they're a VHI patient, it's covered under all insurance. But if they're VHI, they have an exclusive rapid access 10-day appointment time anywhere in the country. That's then followed on by surgical or face-to-face, all done within the following 2-3 weeks. So from the date we accept the referral and the patient to their stitches been removed, it normally is done within 30 days. Now that's in stark contrast to, say, patients were seen for Galway, Letterkenny, Sligo at the moment. A very small volume have come through our system and they're currently waiting about 5 years. What happens there is the hospital actually send the referrals to us. Then we contact the patients on behalf of the HSC, bring them into our clinics, absolutely look after them end-to-end care until they're totally cured, discharged, surgery done, sutures removed. Some of them are long-term care, so they have acne or psoriasis. We manage those as well. And that's basically how they come by the HSC route. The hospital themselves send out the referrals. And really where the issue comes down to is we guarantee we've won tenders with the HSC for the last number of years and they've been repeated. Some hospitals use the service, some don't. We would have given the HSC a capacity of 20,000 patients to be consumed by us this year. About 5,000 patients have gone through the system via the HSC procurement procedure. So the hospitals don't pay for the service. It's paid for by a HSC head office.
So, just to be clear, currently the public health system is using 25% of the capacity that the HSC's approved funding for?
Correct. Yeah. Okay.
Why would, obviously we'd be aware that the dermatologist at Letterkenny University Hospital has recently retired, and we've heard also from the dermatologist in Sligo that he's incredibly concerned with his workload, let alone the increased workload from Donegal patients. And he's saying effectively we could end up with a situation that most people have to travel to Galway for certain types of treatment. So why would a hospital like Letterkenny University Hospital, for an example, not take up some of this capacity?
Letterkenny themselves, just to be clear, Letterkenny Hospital are absolutely behind our service. The business teams say all want to use the service. Yeah. So just not to be confused in that. They would love to see the service go live. I think we've been talking to them now for about a year and a half, similar to Sligo. But they are controlled by the Salta Group. And the Salta Group, the clinicians, the team down there, the business team, the CEOs want to go ahead. It comes down to, we're not sure where the blockage is, but it's somewhere within the dermatology department, why the patients are not being given access. Now, we do believe some of the consultants may have concerns around the technology piece. The National Clinical Lead for Dermatology is based out of Talla Hospital. She has pretty much rejected the use of teledermatology, you know, in Ireland. However, she's never engaged with the service, engaged with us, engaged with teledermatology. The HSC have approved it. It's used.
What's the accuracy rate? I mean, I see in a poster behind you, 98 melanomas and more than 700 other skin cancers in patients who would have otherwise waited on hospital waiting lists until their cancer was much harder to treat or terminal has been identified. But in terms of, you know, picking up cancers...
Yeah, 99.3% is what our current stat is on our accuracy of diagnosis. Anything we can't diagnose through teledermatology is automatically brought in for a face-to-face with the consultant. Or any patients that have certain parameters like a family history of cancer, previous melanoma. So there's certain trigger points within the system.
How many? What percentage then would be false negatives, or are all of the questionable cases kicked up the line, so to speak?
We would from a consultant not knowing what the issue is from teledermatology. About 0.7%. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that's all that's seen face-to-face. So lots of triggers in our system would indicate a patient needs a full skin exam. Everybody ideally should get a full skin exam every 18 months. It's just impossible. There's not enough consultants to do it. Mm-hmm. So ideally, you know, a lot of GPs specialize in skin and they're fantastic. That's who should be used for a skin check. However, their concern then needs to go to a consultant. Mm-hmm. The real core of the issue is there's not enough consultants globally. It's not an Irish issue. You know, people blame the HSE for not recruiting enough consultants and you can't get them. They can't get them anywhere. The UK have over 120 positions for consultant dermatologists at the moment. Ireland, we positions globally, there's just not enough dermatologists. So teledermatology has become a way globally to try and ease that. So a consultant could see 4 or 5 patients in an hour. They can see 15 to 20 patients through telemedicine. That enables them to work on patients. So about 15% of our patients have nothing wrong with them. That's a very small number, you know, per 100%. So to say only 50, a lot of people say there's nothing wrong with lots of patients, that is factually incorrect. Most people on the waiting list, GPs have referred them in for a reason. And we've done 20-something thousand patients in the last 2 years. Our data fits with all the global numbers. There's lots of papers written on this. And about 15% of nothing wrong. About 50% in general are managed remotely. So the consultant reviews it. The consultant reviews the entire case, issues their management plans, and then our GPs talk to the patient. So it's more efficient use of consultant time. And if the consultant for any reason is unsure or thinks I need to see this patient, remember they have images of their entire body. So they're able to see, okay, this person has factors that I need to see them and give them a full skin exam. They're brought in for that. So the technology is only part of the service. You know, a large part go to surgery. That's all done traditionally, just brought in, but it's done rapidly. Mm.
So it's the stumbling block here then is that there are people in the medical profession or the decision makers that have an opinion on this style of diagnosis.
Correct. But yet have not engaged with actually looking into the service or the facts or the global facts. You know, and where the HSE have, the HSE have been out here, the HSE have, there's other telemedicine providers in the country. A lot of them facing the same experience.
But is this not why we have sort of the top tier of management in the HSE, or in fact the Minister for Health, who is the overall boss
myself
person?
2 weeks ago, very pro the service, very much pro the service. It's down to local level politics that is stopping it. So the Colm Henry, the Minister, Mary Day, all these top people in the HSE are actively pushing hospitals to use our service. And I know that every month comes up in the national waiting list discussions about it. So we don't know really why they're not being used. Hospitals in Dublin have seen huge benefits, taken thousands of patients off their lists by using this model. The traditional model, I've seen every single patient face-to-face. I know around half of them could be managed, you know, remotely, is extremely inefficient. 28% of deaths in Ireland are caused by cancer at the moment. Your own Dr. Padraig McGuinness and the Donegal General Practitioners Group, they have huge concerns about melanomas. So melanoma is time sensitive. The quicker you get it, the better outcomes for the patient.
No, and we heard that too from our sole dermatologist in the Northwest as well. And listen, every which way you turn now, and particularly obviously in the summer, you hear the advertisements talking about the dangers of skin cancer and what have you. I don't have a medical background, and I don't know what those that are opposed to this, you know, what they might be thinking. It was beyond my.
I don't know either.
You are of the view, and obviously other hospitals like St. James, Beaumont, Connolly, Our Lady of Lourdes, that they have used this technology, this SolView teledermatology service, and they have concluded that it's drastically reduced their waiting lists. 15,000 HSE patients in the last 2 years. You say you've got much greater capacity that's simply not being used because someone has an opinion that this is not the future.
Correct. Only last night, we won the best hospital project at the Irish Healthcare Awards, and that's our second year to win such a project with Beaumont Hospital, with RTSI, and with St. James's. We won awards for what we've actually done working and partnering with the hospitals. So hospitals that do use the service are really impressed by it. It works very well. We could see about 50 patients a week in Letterkenny. We have a local clinic there, so those patients could all be seen and managed very locally if it was allowed to go ahead. We also have the smallest Breslow thickness, or the lowest Breslow thickness in the country, and that is how you measure cancer, stage 1, 2, 3, 4. We're at 0.68. The average is coming in nearly 2 around the country. So we're dramatically lower than any other service. And that's just purely due to rapid access. So we can take a patient referral and have them in a clinic in 10 days and have them diagnosed. And if they need surgery, they'll be in within a week or two. So, you know, within a month...
Who does the surgery? They're going to the general hospital, the acute hospital for the surgery?
No, they come through our services. So we have consultant dermatologists, consultant plastic surgeons, consultant Maxfax.
Right.
We have histopathologists. We have our own histology labs. We're the largest dermatology provider and by scale, actually, probably the largest dermatology department in the country. And that's primarily, we do both public and private services. So, we're a very big...
So theoretically, then, it could be a case that someone might be opposed to availing of this service if they have this notion of, or not notion, because that sounds like I'm just disregarding it, which I'm not, if they believe that, you know, these are services that should be provided in hospital, that this money should be spent in public hospitals with these services provided in public hospitals, and this is going down this slippery slope of privatising the health service. Someone might have that view and see this as a as to why they might not endorse it. For an example.
There is certainly reluctance in the healthcare system to use private providers. All private hospitals at the moment have capacity. We're only one of six of the main hospital groups who would be on the HSC framework to provide these services to the hospitals. So we know places like Waterford don't use any of the services, any of the providers. Same with, Salted do use in certain areas. We're actually doing ophthalmology work for the Salted group, but it tends to be the dermatology that always... Okay. Is the issue.
It's kind of interesting because the Minister for Health in this programme 2 weeks ago defended the use of the likes of the National Treatment Purchase Fund, for an example. Yeah. He always, he is of the view that it should be a two-track approach. Okay, well, listen, it's food for thought. Thanks for explaining it and helping me through that, Owen, as I learned, really, to be honest with you. I wasn't aware of
these facilities. And just, I suppose, for yourself and your listeners, as we would always say, just think, if you're a privately insured patient, you know, you can be seen in 10 days. If you're public in that area, it's currently running at 5 years. Same service, same technology, same consultants. So our question is why, you know, and where is the blockage?
All right. And congratulations with your success at the Irish Healthcare Awards as well. Thanks.
Thanks a million.
Take care. Bye-bye. And there was local success at those awards, because the Letterkenny University Sports and Social won the National Award in the Irish Healthcare Awards in the Workplace Wellbeing Champion section. So congratulations to all of the committee members there for all of their hard work throughout the years, and to all the members who make, as I'm told, the Sports Social Club a very special group to be a part of. So again, at those, this is just by coincidence, at those Irish Healthcare Awards, big winners on the night, Letterkenny University Hospital Sport and Social. They won the National Award in the Workplace Wellbeing Champion section. Okay, brilliant stuff. Now, we have another beautiful Cadbury hamper to give away today. And we also have another beautiful big Cadbury Santa bar, secret Santa bar to give away as well. We're inviting you once again to share with us why you want to secretly send chocolate to someone special this year. What makes them deserving of this beautiful big Cadbury secret Santa bar? Tell us about a person in your life who deserves this surprise treat, but be sure to keep it a secret. We're going to keep it a secret. So you can text to WhatsApp the reason why someone in your life deserves this secret surprise. Text or WhatsApp your reason, name and address to 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. Now, if you entered on Monday or Tuesday, will you not sort of think in your head, oh, well, my person isn't special enough, I'll not enter again? Resend the message in to us, please, if you want to. Because we go through them all, and there's there comes a point where there's so many good ones, there has to be an element of randomness to it as well. So if you've already nominated someone on Monday or Tuesday, please feel free to send it through again. It's not that we looked at your entry and thought, oh no, that person's not worthy. It's not like that at all, okay? So if you would like yourself for nominating to win a beautiful Cadbury hamper, or the person you're nominating to receive in the post a lovely big Cadbury secret Santa bar, tell us why someone in your life is important to you, why they should win. Text or WhatsApp your reasons, your name and your address to 086 60 25000, and in terms of the postage after the fact, we'll ring you back and sort all that out. But we want a really big entry today, and as I say, if you entered already, please feel free to resubmit that entry, because everyone, we had some, and we'll read some of them out. We've had some brilliant, brilliant entries, and I wish everyone could win. But we don't look at them and go, oh, that's not worthy. It's not really like that at all, okay? 086 60 25000, your WhatsApps and text numbers. Give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Hi, Greg. I was just wondering, could you tell me when to send a parcel to Australia? Thanks, great show. Hopefully I'll have that information for you very shortly. Because I have on the program with me right now, Sarah O'Dwyer, Communications Executive at On Post. Good morning to you, Sarah.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Not too bad. Just by pure coincidence, someone asked me when can I send a parcel to Australia. And you're the person that will tell me all about it. All right, let's run through the Christmas last postal dates 2023. Shall we start with what's nearest first, I wonder?
Yes. So we'll kick off today, actually kicks off our latest dates of posting. So if you are sending a parcel to the likes of Australia, New Zealand, Canada or the US, today is the day you should be getting it in the post if you want to guarantee delivery in time for Christmas. So that's our kind of standard kind of parcel delivery. Before we move on,
because someone's just jumped out of the chair now and tripped over the coffee table running to get out to the post office. But that's guaranteed. It's possible if someone's made an error, heard this and is panicking. If it goes in the post tomorrow, it's not guaranteed. But could we even say it's likely it might get there in time?
So our latest dates of posting, Greg, they are a guide. Yeah. They're just kind of like today would be the latest date we'd say for Australia and New Zealand to guarantee delivery. But obviously we'll do our utmost to get parcels delivered in time for the big day. And if you are kind of concerned that you've missed the latest date, you can ask the people down at your local post office, about other options like Express Post, because the dates that we would give would be for standard letter and parcel delivery. Mm. So do chat to the clerk down at your local post office about the different options that are available to you. But like I say, it is a guide. Just to guarantee delivery in time for the big day.
Are there any rules on what we can and cannot post? I mean, foodstuffs into Australia and New Zealand, because they're islands, of course, they're very defensive on that. Do you have guidelines in relation to that, or is it up to the person posting to double check what applies to whichever is the destination country?
We do have guidelines, yeah. You can find them all on our website, onpost.com. But a general rule of thumb is, act with common sense. You can look up the guidelines yourself in terms of, you can't post batteries and the like. And then with regard to foodstuffs, when posting outside the island of Ireland, it's not even kind of up to us. It is, like you said yourself, customs in other countries.
Well, anyone who has watched those programs on random satellite channels about the Australian customs will know. The New Zealand customs, they will know they're pretty stringent. So be extra careful in relation to that. And what about tax? Tax in different areas? Because that's kind of, the likes of me who doesn't post internationally very often has become more aware of inward post. There might be a tax or a VAT or whatever that's in addition to it. Is that common knowledge? Is there any information we need to give to people about those implications in posting far and wide?
Yeah, it is. It's becoming more common knowledge, especially with Brexit having come in recent years. So there will be some customs to be paid if you're ordering goods from outside the EU. So that will be the likes of America, Australia and the UK. We would say to customers to be mindful when they're ordering online. Generally, the website will tell you if customs is included, if the company that you're ordering off has taken care of it themselves, or if you might be liable to pay when the parcel comes into the country. And then if you're posting abroad, your local post office can help you with the different forms that you might have to fill out for posting to the likes of America and Australia.
Okay, so the rest of the world is today. The US is the 11th, is that correct? Or did you group the...
So for letters or Christmas cards, it's the 11th, but it is actually today for standard parcels.
Right, yeah. Shall we focus on the parcels then? Because people can figure out the letters. Yeah. So what's the next deadline then for parcels?
So the next deadline then we have coming up for the rest of Europe is December 14th. So that would be the likes of France, Spain, Germany... all those countries, we'd ask people if they're sending there to have their parcels in the post by December 14th to guarantee delivery. And then we get right up to very close to Christmas with December 18th for standard delivery of parcels to Great Britain. So if you're posting to, you know, England or Scotland or Wales, December 18th is the date you need to be looking out for. Then we're the very next day for delivery for to Northern Ireland, December 19th. And then right up until December 21st, you can post your cards and parcels for delivery within within Ireland. But I acknowledge I've just given you a rake of dates and information.
No, it's
there. Unpost.com/Christmas is the best way to hop onto our website and get all the latest dates posting, because there's a very clear table there with
Hard you try and push the point, there's going to be a large group of us that do most of our shopping and posting on the 22nd and the 23rd, and then worry about it for the rest of Christmas. All right, good stuff. Anything else you think we need to know? Are we still posting? Do we still post letters in the same? Obviously, we don't do it. Not letters, cards, Christmas cards. Obviously, I don't think we're clearly not going to do it in the same volumes that we used to once. But there's still a good amount of Christmas cards go about the place, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. We actually kicked off, you know, we're really trying to encourage everyone to send their cards and parcels this year. You know, there is nothing quite like getting a Christmas card in the post. It really is a lovely human touch. So actually last year, 3 in 5 adults sent Christmas cards with Unpost in 2022. So people definitely still are sending them. 9 in 10 within that number were sending across Ireland, and 1 in 2 were sending love to the UK. And obviously there's so many Irish expats now over in the likes of Australia and America and Canada. So it definitely is, you know, still a trend and people are still doing it. And then just with regard to kind of good practice for posting your cards and parcels, we would say make sure you wrap up your parcel really, really well, seal it very well, especially if it's going abroad. And always remember to include the return address as well, that on the very off chance it doesn't get delivered, we can get it back to you. So that's really important as well.
Yeah, and I kind of joked about after these deadlines, but in all seriousness, you should note that there'll be no mail delivery or collections from the 23rd until the 27th. So there will be people might be waiting on a delivery on the 23rd or 24th, but delivery and collection cease on the 23rd until the 27th. And then your next post after those dates, or the next time you can post something and expect it to be processed, is the 28th. Delivery and collection services return on December 28th. So if you haven't got it by 23rd, you're not getting it.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we, the staff, both in the post offices and the mail centres across the country, they are flat to the mat at the moment, making sure that everyone gets their cards and parcels.
They're like your little elves, Sarah, aren't they? They're like your little elves, busying away.
But it is—it's a colossal effort, and we really are doing our utmost to make sure everyone has everything that they need for Christmas Day and all the festivities. Which is why, as you said, the latest dates of posting—they really are kind of important to follow. You know, so we can all work together to get everything sorted and delivered to you in time for Christmas Day.
Yeah, it's a huge logistical thing, the Postal Service. All right, listen, thanks for that, Sarah. Appreciate your time. Happy Christmas.
No problem at all. Happy Christmas
Bye.
To you too.
Okay. So standard post for parcels, the Christmas date, days. For the rest of the world, it's today. For the USA, it's today. For the rest of Europe, December 14th. For Great Britain, or Britain, subscribe, whichever way you want to call it, December 18th for the North, the Northern Ireland, it is the counties, December 19th. And for the Republic of Ireland, December 21st. And there's no post, either delivery or collections, from the 23rd to the 27th of December. Is the post office doing free delivery of packages and letters up to 1 kilo to nursing homes this year? We'll ring back and check that, Caroline, if that's all right. We'll find out. That's... was it a COVID initiative? I haven't heard anything of it since. But anyway, hi, just wondering, could you tell me when to send a parcel to Australia? Thanks. Great show, Greg. Thank you for the lovely compliment. Today, get down to the post office. If it's standard delivery, today is the last day where they guarantee as much as they can that your parcel will reach your loved one or your friend in Australia. Bettina joins us on the programme now. Hi, Bettina.
Good morning, Craig. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to speak to you. Bettina, you wanted to go up on what has been beautiful, crisp mornings to visit on Grinia of Alia, and you've, as a family, were left disappointed. Tell us why and what happened.
Well, I got there about 2:30, and I found that the monument was locked, the monument itself. And there was another couple, a German couple there, and they obviously came a good distance to see the monument, and they found very disappointingly the gate closed, unable to get inside. And as I walked down, a travel coach came up, with fully seated, fully booked with people having paid for to see the monument, and being left very disappointed and frustrated as well to return from the monument without being able to go inside.
And what reason has been given, and it's, I suppose it's dictated by the sign, as for access to be restricted?
Well, yeah, they basically, I presume they haven't done an official statement to OPW. On my social media, I had someone commenting, echoing the opinion of the OPW, and basically the line was, it's for our own good, for our own safety, because we are probably too reckless and would go stairs which are frozen and therefore might put in a claim towards to the OPW. I don't even know if that is legally possible, because I'm not sure what the liability is there. But also other comments on my post made it quite clear that it wasn't just yesterday or the last couple of days where there actually were icy conditions, but that the monument has been closed for at least 3 weeks. One person who commented was at a conference on the 14th of November, mm-hmm. and he took up two guest speakers, one from France and one from the UK, around the same time as I was there yesterday, 2:30, and the monument was locked. And other people who commented had the same experience for this period of time. So the monument has been closed mm-hmm. day in, day out for the last 3 weeks.
You're of the view, really, any excuse is being used to withhold access to this monument?
Yeah, I mean, as I saw the tour bus yesterday, it kind of dawned on me, because tour buses are still coming. And as I said, they are paid, booked and paid tours. And if tour operators not only take home a load full of frustrated visitors, but also will receive complaints, then tour operator probably will cut down on visits to the monument because of the problem occurring that they do not know if the monument is open or not.
Yeah, the inconsistency means that it becomes unattractive. That being said, just to play devil's yes. advocate here, looking beyond the closed due to icy conditions sign, it does look kind of frosty and icy on that footpath. Do you think it should be opened and treated, or it should be opened and people should be able to assume their own risk?
It could be treated. I mean, I visited the Green for the last 27 years, and I never actually seen it treated. That is the photo is where the new access is for the wheelchair.
Understood.
And it was frosty. It wasn't icy. The water actually runs off quite well from the monument and from those new access, wheelchair access. I mean, if they have someone in charge there, they could treat it. But one of my fondest memory of the monument are mornings, on a snowy morning, when I went to the Green, and my footsteps were the first on top of the monument, and then I took a photo and made a Christmas card from it.
Oh,
there is something absolutely magical about it, you know.
I think, Bettina, and I do have to move on. It just seems that it's almost coming to the point that more often than not, we're talking about access to this wonderful amenity being blocked, and we've discussed this in great detail in the past. I mean, and also too, I mean, we can't be wrapped up in cotton wool either. You know, we have to be able to employ our own common sense to some extent, you would feel. But anyway, we'll get an official response. Bettina, I have to go for the news at 10. Thank you very much for your time, and thanks for accepting the invite to come on and talk about that with us.